I'm Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf. Making his second appearance on the show is John Rossman. John hit my radar 2 years ago. His book, The Amazon Way, made my top 10 list of favorite books in 2022. His newest book that he co-authored is Big Bet Leadership. It's practical, fast-moving, applicable, whether you are high-tech, low-tech, big company, small biz, private, or a nonprofit. John Rossman and Big Bet Leadership, that's coming up next here on CFO Bookshelf. I started my conversation with John by thanking him, and I even embarrassed myself when doing so, but we decided not to cut out my silly mistake. John, first of all, I love this book. I'm holding it in my hand. By the way, I have your signature in it, and I'm going to guess that that's not a stamp. I'm going to guess that you actually wrote this. Thank you very much. So how does it...
I write my own signatures. I believe, you know, the best thing about a book, the best opportunity is creating real relationships. And so I take the time.
And by the way, I love the feel of this book. It's only 170 plus pages. It's not, now I do read long books, but it's not 200 pages, not 300 pages. This is just the perfect book. Did you know that going into this? Did you say it's going to be less?
We had a few design principles. And, you know, one of the design principles was really just about the reader experience, and that goes along with the listener experience. And so we wanted the book to be very narrative, kind of pull you through it, and to be a great audio experience. So we didn't overdo it with graphics or bullet points or technicalities, but we follow up with all of the details with a set of resources that you get with the book. And so we really balanced it out. And we were also very careful about kind of like, what's the mission of the book and what's the scope of the book? There's a few things that we think would be great, either white papers or additional books that are really connected to this concept of big bets. But we were very specific about our mission and who our reader is and what we were trying to deliver to the reader.
By the way, I'm going to come clean. When I read nonfiction, one of the first things I typically do, I do read the cover. I have the hard copy, so I get to read about the authors. We're going to talk about your co-author in a minute. But I start from the back, and I'm holding this up. You probably can't see this very well, but I will read the notes, the note disclosures on the very back, the end notes. And did you know I got distracted even before I started reading? It's like, well, this looks really good. This looks really good. I saw Tufte in the appendix, which I found out why, because he is in the appendix. But that led me to, so the research is very well done. That's even before I started reading the preface, the introduction in the first chapter. But I want to say congratulations. How does it feel to be a three-time author?
Well, it feels great to be a three-time author. It feels even better to be a four-time author.
Oh, my gosh. Author. Did you say four? Did you say four?
Which is what this book is, but you know, one of the books kind of gets left in the way and everything. But you know, it's interesting. So this is the fourth book. Each book has brought different unplanned opportunities out of it. And the book that didn't sell well, it's called The Amazon Way on IoT, and it's a business strategy book about technology. That book brought me a set of relationships that are really precious to me and a set of opportunities that were very different than my other books. And so it's still a very worthwhile journey, but this is my fourth one. So thanks.
We mentioned in the intro your last book, which we interviewed you about 2 years ago. Just a quick note. This is interesting. Goodreads. Did you know on Goodreads, you have over 2,000 reviews? On Goodreads, as of this interview, you're at 4.0. Do you know how hard it is to get 4.0 or higher on Goodreads? It's almost like impossible. You could be some of the top authors ever, and be under four. So I'm just saying that your last book has performed very, very well. And the Goodreads is like, I mean, that is a tough bunch to please. Well done.
Well, so that's the Amazon way. And it's kind of my story at Amazon and the Amazon leadership principles. And, you know, I always joke, it's just the first time I paid attention in class. And it's such an interesting organization. And I was so lucky to get to have the role I had at the time I had it and to participate there. And I kind of thought I was a good operator and a good thinker before I went there and everything. And it was just a PhD level class in clear thinking, execution, making choices, building teams, what strategy is, what culture is, how to rethink from a customer's perspective, like all of those things. It was fabulous.
And you did get a dressing down in one meeting that we're going to talk about in a few minutes.
It was more than one meeting.
Oh, I'm glad your humility level is high, because we're going to bring this up. But you're the one that mentions it in the book. Hey, real quickly on Big Bet Leadership, you have a co-author, Kevin McCaffrey, and I did not know something until I looked him up. I looked him up on LinkedIn, and then wait a minute. I did not know that John had a new consulting practice. Is that new within the last 2 years?
So Rossman Partners has been my business entity for the past 7 years, but my wife would always poke me like, well, who's the S in Rossman Partners? And I would always say, oh, it's a French bulldog. But Kevin is now the S in Rossman Partners. And so he has joined Rossman Partners. And we are a leadership development and strategy firm. We have solutions and advisory practices, and we will do consulting, but we have a very specific framework and an extremely high leverage approach to doing our work, which is high impact for our clients and really interesting work for us. And what we focus on is wicked problems, like really difficult situations, because we think we are completely different than anybody else in helping our clients rethink really complex situations.
Well, let's dive into the book real quickly. And I will just say that this book has a big idea in it. The big idea is defined. It's defined as in what it isn't as well. And then the rest of the book is, here's how to apply this. So I wanted to say that up front, because we're going to be kind of just hitting all different parts of the book without necessarily getting into the recipe, because we want readers to figure out the recipe. So I'm just going to hit some of the big, big points in this book. I know you've done a lot of these interviews, so I hope this is not a crazy way of approaching this conversation. But first thing I want to do is, now I work with a lot of smaller organizations. I have a few that are $50 million to $100 million. Those are on the small side. Most of the businesses I work with are $50 million or under. I want to read the subtitle of the book, because I have a question, John. The Transformation Playbook for Winning in the Hyper-Digital Era. This is my opinion after reading your book once and then skimming it about 6 or 7 times just to make sure I haven't missed anything. This book is also for low-tech companies. That's a strong opinion. Am I okay in saying that?
Absolutely. And one of our missions is to help small and mid-sized companies get far better strategic thinking in their business than they're typically serviced with. It's only the big enterprises that are able to afford, you know, the McKinseys and the Bains of the world. And so this book is a set of frameworks and advice and ways to help you rethink as though you are a superstar strategy consultant. And so, but absolutely, this applies not just at the business level, but can apply at a team or a product level too. But yeah, it absolutely is for I've been running this playbook with a couple of manufacturing clients of mine, service clients, traditional analog businesses that have to find new value propositions, have to create cost model innovations, have to find ways to differentiate in the market, or they are reverting to the mean. And we know that competitive advantage is short-lived. And I think the future is going to be defined by even more change, which is what the subtitle of the book about, the hyper-digital era, is about. I think we are coming into an era where even more change than the past 25 years of digital transformation has presented us.
Can I be nosy without giving away the name of the business? You mentioned analog. What are a couple of examples of some of these analog organizations you're helping?
Yeah. I mean, industrial cooling, manufacturing, and services business is the one that I was specifically thinking about.
And what a stodgy industry. Very set in their ways.
Yeah, but you know, there's a tremendous amount of change and innovation and regulation, you know, involved in the business. And he's a very small operator, but has a real distinct design and set of capabilities. And we've been really thinking about how to frame that better, how to accentuate the differentiation, and kind of how to go big on it without risking a ton, which is the whole nature of what the playbook is about. It's, you know, one of the chapters is called, you know, think big, but bet small, right? And so people get this wrong about like what an actual big bet is.
Instead of saying, give me a definition, let's start out with what a big bet is not.
Yeah. So a big bet is not an incremental, well-understood move in your business. So, you know, if you run a fulfillment business and the next incremental move is to build a new fulfillment center, you probably understand it really well, how to do it, what the economics are going to be, what the financial return profile on it is going to be. That is not a big bet because it's a well-understood incremental move.
You talk about Jeff in his day one definition and day two. And it's like, then the light came on. Oh, you're probably not going to see a lot of big bets in a day two company, because day two company is thinking about the here and now, profits, cash flow right now, whereas day one is willing to sacrifice profits. Okay, they're willing to cannibalize a little bit because they're thinking, am I getting that? Am I interpreting that right? That probably in a day one company, that's where you're going to see your big bets, right?
Yeah. So, you know, day one is this kind of framing that Jeff gives as a kind of a mission for Amazon about that. You know, we're always going to be inventing the future, trying to take advantage of it. We're always going to be optimizing for long-term, durable returns and not short-term optimization. And so it's framed as like, well, the only other option is being day two, which is kind of, as you said, is kind of, you know, short-term operated and everything. I actually do think that, like, who said there can only be two versions? Like, there is maybe a day three company. And a day three company is maybe when your business has eroded to a point where you have to make a Hail Mary, right? And a Hail Mary is a big bet where you have no patience for it. You have very limited resources and it has to work. I was a partner in a restructuring business for 12 years. And so I've dealt with my Hail Marys and everything. And those are tricky situations. Some of this playbook can definitely apply in those cases, but you are far better off when you can start early, take advantage of the advantages you have, including the two key ones, which is resources and time to be patient, to let these things, to prove out the critical aspects of the big bet before you actually commit big to it. And that's the fundamental mistake that so many companies get sideways on, is they have a big bet, they have a concept, and they commit to it in every way possible before they actually prove out the critical high-risk components of it. And that's when things really start going sideways on them.
I just read, when we interviewed you a couple of years ago, one of your favorite books you mentioned was The Effective Executive interesting because that's one of my favorite books. And one of my favorite sections in that book is the elements of decision-making. Well, guess what? Theodore Vail is mentioned in that chapter, and he's kind of famous for, we're going to go long on Bell Labs. We're going to go long. But his board did not want to do that because they're focused on today's profits. So with that in mind, you talk about when you form a team, it's not a lab.
Yeah, a lot of my experience has been working with enterprises in, you know, creating some type of new business venture incubation. That's where Kevin and I worked together first when he was at T-Mobile, and I got to advise them for a couple of years. And these labs tend to be highly unaccountable relative to their resources, their missions. They've twisted what the agile methodology is all about. It literally comes across as like the methodology of no accountability, right? And so you have to put constraints and connection points between the business and in these teams, and you have to keep them highly accountable, but for the right things. And that's really where we designed this set of both, you know, kind of tactics and constraints that help. It's not just the team, it's the involvement with the rest of the organization has to be calibrated, it has to be fit correctly, like gears working together to get that rhythm, get those expectations set right. So that's a lot of the book, is both the team structure and how they work with other, especially senior leaders within the organization.
I was going to say, at Bell Labs, I mean, they were completely different. I mean, they were...
That was an R&D organization.
Exactly. Right? So again, this, well stated, because we're not talking about R&D. We're talking about a small team set aside that's going to be very much in contact with that future customer, or it could maybe an ongoing customer, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, this is... you know, 98% of most organizations don't do true R&D, right? And so for most of us, it's kind of an applied innovation scenario. And that's not the only type of big bet, right? And so a big bet can do it, can be a major market entry approach, can be a merger acquisition. You know, all these digital transformations tend to be big bets. It can be any major move where you think it has high potential impact, but you know that there's material risk relative. And that's beyond execution risk. It's actual conceptual risk. And so that's what a big bet is. And so it can be beyond kind of an innovation lab scenario, but it definitely includes those.
John, you have done work for the Gates Foundation, and you mentioned the story, I believe it's In Bloom, if I got that right. There was failure there. What happened, and what can we learn about that as we start acting on some of these big bets in our organizations?
Yeah, so I got to work for a number of years with the Gates Foundation and my team there. And In Bloom was bred out of some of the TARP programs that came about out of the financial failure. And so there was kind of this race to the top program that came from U.S. education. And the goal was to create a personalized yet scalable learning platform for school districts so that, you know, conceptually a teacher with small cohorts could have the real interesting insights to a set of student cohorts matched against the content and curriculum that was needed at scale. And so that was kind of the value proposition of In Bloom. But what didn't get tested out well was a lot of the reaction and counter forces that would go against this. And so, you know, and I quoted in the book, you know, a nice one-line summary of what went wrong with In Bloom. And it really was a set of untested major assumptions, some technical, some operating, but a lot about incentives and the change that was going to be required that really could have been forecasted and tested much better than they were. But instead, like, we had a big vision, and we're put in a position where, you know, we went all in, and regrettably, I think a really important concept and capability failed because of that.
I want to switch gears just quickly. I want to pretend like my name is Josh. I work for a grocery store chain in the Midwest. We have 113 grocery stores, mainly in rural areas. We started a digital project. Again, my name is Josh. Does this sound familiar?
I think I know Josh.
I changed the backstory just a little bit. And I have a cross-functional team, and we're going to have our first meeting with not just the senior leadership team, but a couple of others, some of the store managers. And one of the first questions I'm going to ask them is, what do you think of our vision? So I'm coming to you for advice, and that's going to be my first question when we have this first rollout meeting. That's a good idea, right? For us to ask, what do you think of our vision, right?
Yeah, it's not where I like to start. I like to start on the real problems that are operating in the business, Josh. And my guess is you probably have some rudimentary buy online, pick up at store capability. My guess is it's underperforming. My guess is it's operationally very complex. My guess is that those orders are highly unprofitable. But your customers really, some customers really do want to work with you that way. And you're probably losing some business, some of your best customers, to grocery chains that have a more fluid, effortless buy online, pick up in store. So that's a problem, Josh. And so, you know, let's start with a you know, it's also an opportunity, right? But let's start with a problem in the business and work on solving that. And that, I think, is the essence of real strategy work, which is solving a problem in business that becomes a strength and an opportunity, and you build very specific principles for how you're going to solve it, and then test a set of tactics that align with those principles.
I also had a little talk with Josh, pulled him aside. Now, I had already read your book, so I was an expert. And by the way, I love chapter 7. Chapter 7 is one of my favorite chapters in the book. And you bring up three questions. Stephen Krug wrote this book called Don't Make Me Think. I just love the title. I can't remember what's inside the book. I just love the title. I love the cover of the book. And you bring up three questions. And do you know what I'm talking about? The three scenarios?
The three scenario. Yeah. And so
this is brilliant.
What oftentimes happens at a senior level is, you know, a team is given a mission of like, hey, you know, develop a program, a proposal, a vision for how we're going to go do something and everything. And they spend a lot of time perfecting a vision for what that is. They bring it to the senior executive team. So they're 100x prepared. The senior executives know their business well, and they've been hearing some headlines from the project. And then you have this big high stakes meeting where the team presents this vision, and it's really an awkward moment. And it's really a moment of failure where the whole battlefield was set up correctly, because it's an unfair battle. The executives are put in a extremely tenuous position. First of all, you have a team that you like these people. You want to, you know, create a positive environment. And so, you know, and it's really good work, but it's just one version of what the future could be. And they essentially, they ask you, well, what's wrong? You know, tell me what you like and don't like about this vision. Well, that's a very tough on the fly homework assignment, right, to give to an executive. So what we propose is a better version of that, which is you write three versions of a memo of what the potential future could be. All three versions have to be a real option. So it can't be a, you know, the cold, medium, hot version of the porridge situation, where of course it's only the medium version is the right one. No, all three options have to be. It's a constrained memo, so it's not too long. You send it to the executive team before the meeting, and then you ask them a set of questions that actually pulls out of them much better in-depth feedback that you can actually react to. And what you're doing, you're not trying to get agreement. What you're trying to do is surface the real tensions and the real concerns out of these. Because if you do that early, then you can actually work to address them. And so that's called the Three Futures Memo. And it's a really powerful technique, both from a principal standpoint, as well as from a tactical standpoint of, you know, this book is written for senior executives, right? And it really helps senior executives do their really hard jobs well, which is react to these proposals that are one-sided in nature.
And that's what I meant by Stephen Krug, don't make me think. You're kind of slowing down the game, and you're giving someone a chance to focus instead of zero focus. So I just, in the margin, I even wrote just, this is great. And right now, this has now become sticky. I don't know if I'll ever get this out of my head. It's a great concept. You do give another idea a page over about, hey, let's put some constraints. So even don't make me think even more, put some constraints. Our friend Peter Drucker would say, let's have some boundary conditions on these constraints. And again, I just, this whole section was just, I loved it, John. It's you and your co-author, I feel like, knocked it out of the ballpark on that concept.
Well, you know, the book has three sections, right? Big bet thinking, big bet environment, and big bet management. And I think the big bet thinking is the one that is going to get a lot of immediate attention, and it's so actionable, and it's such a different way of thinking. But the hidden superpowers that are in here, I think a lot of them are buried in big bet management, where we talk about governance and these high stakes meetings, and how to actually, as a senior leader, lead these big bet different than you do all of your other kind of normal course of business and normal projects. They do require a different feel from senior leadership.
This book is heavy, and I hope I'm not overstating this, but it's heavy on, you're going to have to write. You're going to have to like to write, because I've written down all the different types of memos, the what sticks memo, the outcome definition memo. So I could keep just going on, but I want to make a comment, and I want to defend, if anyone says this is ridiculous or this is crazy, I want to defend this concept of writing. And it's becoming a very strong opinion as of the last few years. I loved the book Becoming Trader Joe. It may be one of my all-time favorite business books. That's stating it. I mean, that's maybe an exaggeration. It's in the top seven. Joe Coulombe wrote extensively. He would handwrite out his five-year plan. And I don't think he did it just to feel good. There's something about putting something on paper. It's causing you, forcing you to think clearly. We've already mentioned Peter Drucker twice. He recommended the same thing. So I just wanted to state real quickly, I hope there's no turnoff with the memos in here, because, I mean, you went through this at Amazon. This writing is going to be, it could be very transformative. Just the act of going through the exercise of writing stuff down. So I'm breaking the rule of talking instead of asking a question. But I just, as you're doing public speaking, and if anyone ever says we don't want to do this writing, boy, there's a million reasons why this is healthy to do.
You know, I would double down on, especially when these are really complex problems we're trying to solve,
right?
And you're positioning a really big move or investment or change for an organization, slowing down, writing it out will help you think through it so much better, make connections that you don't make, ability to communicate it to others, able to audit it backwards, all of these assets you get, these capabilities you get with writing things out that you don't get by having PowerPoint conversations.
I will never, ever, ever, never interview Jeff Bezos. If I do, I do have a question for him. Have you ever written a memo and then changed your mind based on writing that memo? Oh, I'm not going to do this. That would be my first and only question for Jeff.
One of the things we suggest is, you know, a real problem is having just one idea. So you want to have a portfolio of ideas. 9 out of 10, you aren't going to proceed on. They tend to be really good ideas, but you have limited resources. You have limited bandwidth. It's right. You have to choose the best out of really good ideas. And so you always want to have a portfolio of these ideas. So, but this is, you know, it feels slow. It feels like you're spending a lot of time, but think about like what an investment means to not just the business, but to your career and everything. Right. And so I think it's the only way to operate. And if you look at any good hedge fund or PE fund, like what do? They do investment committee memos, right, and everything, right? They write these things out. They debate them. 9 out of 10 deals, maybe they don't proceed on, right? And so saying no is and avoiding what looks like a good idea, but it's not the best idea for you to proceed on. That's a big part of what makes, you know, great winners versus, you know, kind of lukewarm, okay outcomes.
Now, I'm holding up in my hand a small booklet. It may look like a little address book. It's not. It's a little memo book to where I can write down big ideas. I drive an F-150 and I do a fair amount of driving. This is my, I've gone through like 10 or 11 of these. So this is like one of my earlier versions. Never throw this away. So I love, love, love this concept. Hey, do we have time for a quick lightning round?
You get about
20, 30 seconds. Now here's the hard part. You've not seen this list. And if you want to skip, just say skip. We'll go on to the next one. No, I'm sorry. Because what's going to be hard, John, is you're going to think, okay, what's the context? Authors have read the book so many times, they get sick of it to where they don't read it. They've probably forgotten. So there may be some parts that you don't remember. So I've had the advantage
I'll guarantee you that will be my challenge. There will be some parts I don't remember and everything. But yeah, let's do it.
Lazy pivot.
So a lazy pivot is when you're not aware of a significant change that you're making in a program direction. And those happen all the time. Like, hey, you know, like this happened and we just keep going. That's a lazy pivot where somebody doesn't recognize and say, stop. This is a moment of inflection. And where it oftentimes happens, lazy pivot habits, it's on the ambition side of a project. People start to tunnel on these projects and what they focus on is budget and time. And what they'll compromise on is the impact, the ambition of a project. And that just, they tend to just slide in and you don't realize you've taken the poison until it's way later in the program. That's what a lazy pivot is.
The next one is, I really like this term, the chief repeating officer. The chief repeating officer. The other CRO.
Yeah, so, you know, one of a key executive's job is to, you know, leadership is the skill, the practical skill of bringing others along to influence them for a specific mission. So if our mission is this big bet, you have to be able to communicate it at the right level, at the right direction with the right caveats and everything. And what happens is executives, they tend to focus on the wrong type of communication and it tends to be inconsistent communication. So what we deliver is a quiver that lets you have the right message for the right audience in a very consistent way that sets the right expectation about where we are going and why we are doing it.
You are cheating because my next word is quivers. Quivers, John, you just said it.
I did. Yeah. So, quiver is a set of tools that go get a job done, right? And so, you know, we don't script out for you like exactly which things to do, but we give you a set of tools that you can go go use for this specific job of being a chief repeating officer?
Here's one. Let me know if I need to say what the middle letter stands for. I don't think I will. M, L as in Larry, P as in Paul, MLP.
Yeah, so an MLP is a minimal lovable project product. And I think what the difference of that is like focusing on the true killer feature, killer use case, not all the requirements, not everything that needs to be done. And, you know, that's the job of true agility, is understanding the critical thing that is going to get your customer switched and testing that out, deferring everything else as much as possible. It's one of the three critical habits that Big Bet Legends have, is this ability to accelerate high risk, high value aspects and defer everything else until you've de-risked it.
I think my research analyst thinks she is a comedian, because I see on my list French bulldog and water polo caps. Why are those terms in there? You are laughing, sir.
Hang on. My French bulldog is whining at the door. I can go get the boss.
Oh my gosh.
And have him make an introduction.
By the way,
hang on.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that in the book, we learn a few things about you personally. We learn that you do work out. We learn that you have a French bulldog. And then we learn that one of your kids, and by the way, you were mentioning this in passing, but you mentioned one of your kids plays water polo. So that's where someone's being funny and put French bulldog in the list and water polo caps. So,
So the French bulldog is Bossman Rossman, and he's a fun part of our family, and he made the book. And then both my boys actually played water polo through college, and it was a ton of fun for them and a ton of fun for the family. We had a great adventure.
What a tough sport, because I do watch it during the Olympics, and it just, what a draining, that's got to be a draining sport.
It's incredibly technical. People think of it as just physical, but it's like wrestling, right? Wrestling is one of the most physically demanding sports, but it's also a highly technical sport, right? And water polo is the same way. It's you know, about creating leverage and separation and advantage over your opponent. And it's a definite team sport with individual movements and capabilities. So it's a really, it was a fun part of our life.
Relentless sequentiality, say that three times in a row, clearly, without fumbling all of yourself, maybe only I will. That term comes up in the appendix. I love the appendix. We could do a show on the appendix. Take it away.
And so the appendix is kind of like the research of why memos matter, right? And so we kind of pulled it out of the book and like put it in an appendix. It's like, it, regardless of what you think of our memos, like writing is a superpower. And, you know, that's a concept from Tuft, I believe, about like what happens with PowerPoint presentations of just this endless sequentiality of between the graphs, the slide, and the speaker presentation, you know, the audience that's being presented to just gets pounded into submission. And it's a horrible way to contemplate high risk, high value decisions.
Again, thank you for this book. Thank you for the hard copy. Thank you for signing it. Again, I took a lot of notes in this book. And last question, you've been through this before. You are a reader. I know one of your favorite books is The Effective Executive. I think you mentioned Shoe Dog on your list, but have you had time to do any reading the last couple of years? Any books that stand out?
Yeah, well, one of them came as a recommendation from my co-author, which was the book Essentialism. I recently finished. That was good. And then another good one was Number Go Up, which was kind of the story of crypto and FTX and everything. That was just a really good read. So both of those books were two recent ones that I really enjoyed. But yeah, I tend to get through you know, about a book a week and everything. So,
number ago, we had that author on, and I just thought, what a crazy book. And when I read it, and we got pretty lucky, he had not done a whole lot of interviews just yet. So I think we're kind of in the early wave.
Well, I got to go back and listen to that, because he did a really nice job writing it. He made it a great story. It's easy to, he really explained some of the technical stuff really well. And it has just a great thread through the whole book.
It's like reading 8 different Atlantic articles. I mean, they were just all, I did not know what to expect. And so I get all these weird, crazy stories out of nowhere. And I think that's what made the book, the narrative special.
I also read The Infinite Game by Michael Moore. And I thought Number Goes Up kind of trumped that story. So
definitely. Well, John, again, thank you very much. Again, I love the book. I've enjoyed, authors have been on for a second time. Our list is short, even though we've done 200. I think you're going to be about 202. So our list is short of 2-time authors being on the show. So I hope, I want it to be 3.
I'm honored, and your preparation and incredible presentation just makes this a ton of fun for me and everything. So I really want to thank you.
You are listening to CFO Bookshelf, lifelong learning for financial leaders. And now back to our host, Mark Gandy.
John Rossman, co-author of Big Bet Leadership. Again, thank you very much. His other book, The Amazon Way, Amazon's 14 Leadership Principles, was on my 2022 top 10 list of books I read. Check that out too if you've not read it. And again, he also has 2 other books, Think Like Amazon and The Amazon Way of IoT. Hey, can you practice the 1-2-3 rule? The 1-2-3 rule is, can you tell 3 people your 2 favorite episodes of CFO Bookshelf and the number 1 reason you listen to the show? That would be amazing. We need to call this a wrap. I'm Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf.